Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, Alan Saunders with you for the Philosopher's Zone, and this week, the ethics of keeping your mouth shut. We're looking at a famous American murder trial from the 1970s, and what we're concerned about is the behaviour of the defence lawyers. That's why the case is still discussed today. In popular culture, defence lawyers are often presented as brave underdogs going into battle against powerful people and institutions. But particularly on American TV shows like Law and Order, they're more likely to be naive crim lovers, anti-authority troublemakers or publicity seekers making a name for themselves by way of their brutal clients. Essentially, they are to blame for bad and dangerous people going free. Today's show centres on the lawyers Frank Armani and Frank Belgi, who were pilloried for something they did, or more precisely did not do, when representing their client on a murder charge. They were publicly harassed and threatened. Charges were laid and later dropped against one of them, and their careers were destroyed, though Frank Armani later rebuilt his legal practice. But what was it they did wrong?
Your mind's screaming one way, relieve these parents, you know, what is your responsibility? Should you report this? Shouldn't you report it? You know, one sense of morality wants you to relieve the grief.
We were all outraged at the fact that, you know, there were probably people that knew more than was ever told, and it just seems though the judicial system was more in favor of the guilty.
People in the community seem to take sides.
In what way?
I don't know. They were just kind of like mean. Some wouldn't even speak to you if you'd go to the post office.
Lisa Lerman is Professor of Law at the Catholic University of America.
In the early 70s in upstate New York, a series of murders happened of young teenagers, most of them girls, some boys. And there was one particular case involving a 16-year-old boy named Philip Domblewski, who was on a camping trip with some friends and was murdered by a psychopath in the woods. The other kids were rescued by the police. And then ensued the largest manhunt that had ever taken place in New York State. And after 11 days, they caught who they thought was the killer, a man named Robert Garrow.
Who was he?
Well, Garrow, to many people who knew him, he seemed like a fairly normal guy. He was a master mechanic at a bakery. He was married. He had three children. But he was a very disturbed person and seems to have had a kind of secret life where periodically he kidnapped young girls and raped them and sometimes killed them and sometimes killed their boyfriends. And so he had a history of criminal charges. He had spent 8 years in prison on a prior sexual assault case.
And this comes after an abusive childhood and, I gather, sex with animals on his part?
Yeah, Garrow had a very difficult relationship with his parents. Apparently, they beat him a lot. And then when he was seven, they sent him to work on a neighbor's farm. And he stayed there 8 years. And during that period, he's reported to have begun having sex with animals and drinking animals' blood.
Oh, dear. So Robert Garrow was charged with the murder of 18-year-old Philip Domblewski. He was also a suspect in a number of other murder and rape cases making news at the time, but he was not indicted for any other murders until after the Domblewski trial was over. The two defence lawyers at the centre of everything were Frank Belgi and Frank Armani. Here's Lisa Lerman.
Belgi and Armani were good friends, and Armani said that his nickname for Belgi was, I don't know if you can say this on the radio, was Balls, because Belgi was a really flamboyant, sort of outspoken, shoot-from-the-hip trial lawyer. And Armani said that he had never represented anyone on a murder charge before, and he was afraid, and he felt he needed courage. So he went to Belgi, and after some wrangling, persuaded Belgi to act as his co-counsel. Belgi didn't want to do it because it was such a notorious case. They knew that it was going to take up enormous amounts of time, and Garrow didn't have any money, so they were going to get paid the pittance that the state pays criminal defense lawyers for indigents in the United States.
We don't want to get bogged down in the jurisdictional differences between here and the US, or between the rules that applied now and those that existed in the 1970s. Suffice it to say that in Australia we have what's known as legal professional privilege, which in the US, and possibly many of us are more familiar with the US rules because we've seen American
television.
TV, yeah, you have attorney-client privilege. And this principle has been in place in our legal systems in one form or another for centuries. So can you give us a quick theoretical overview of why this confidentiality exists and then how it applies to the present case?
Okay. Well, to start with, we have a justice system in which people who are accused of crimes are entitled to be represented by counsel. And we want clients who are accused of crimes to communicate fully and openly with their counsel, the idea being that then they get represented better. And so because of that, if you want the person accused of a crime to speak openly with his lawyer, then you have to have a lawyer who is obliged to keep confidential everything that his client tells him. If the lawyer were to spill the beans on what his client had told him about a crime that he had committed in the past, then all of a sudden the lawyer would be an agent of the police department or the prosecutor's office and would be essentially helping to convict the client. And we've got a whole criminal justice system that takes care of that part. So we kind of cordon off the lawyer and ask him to protect confidences.
And this is the key factor in the present case, isn't it?
It is. And when Armani eventually agreed to take on this murder case and went to see Garrow in the hospital, Garrow had been apprehended by the police and had been shot in the course of that chase. So he was in the hospital. And Armani started asking him about these cases, and Garrow was telling Armani such as he could remember, but he couldn't remember anything. And so Armani, believing that he really needed the information in order to represent Garrow, Armani had a little casual training in hypnosis, and so he persuaded his client to allow the lawyer to hypnotize him. And while under hypnosis, Armani told Garrow that when he woke up, he would remember everything that had happened in the last couple of months.
Ethically, this is a slightly bizarre, isn't it? Because if you hypnotize your client, fair enough, everything your client tells you is protected by attorney-client privilege, but it's rather odd that you hypnotize your client, who may then tell you things that he didn't intend to tell you.
It is rather odd. And even if you could justify hypnotizing a client who was mentally okay, could a client who's obviously severely disturbed and probably psychotic give a meaningful consent to hypnosis? And even if he could, then shouldn't you, before you do this weird thing, shouldn't you consult with your co-counsel? But
Armani didn't consult with Belgi at this point.
He didn't tell Belgi about it because he said he thought Belgi would think he was nuts. So he just went on and did it anyway. And it worked, because then Belgi went to visit Garrow that afternoon, and Garrow told in lurid detail about the murders of Alicia Houck and Susan Petz, who were two teenage girls who were missing. And that it was suspected that they had been murdered, but nobody really knew whether they had been murdered, and if so, where their remains were.
Now, you present this case as an ethical dilemma to your students. So when you take them to this point in the case, what are the options available to them?
Well, when you get to that point in the real case, what actually happened after they learned this information is that they were just dumbfounded about what to do. First of all, their client is a little bit nuts. And so could he be making this up? He was under hypnosis. Does that reduce the reliability of what he's saying? Even if he's telling the truth or thinks he's telling the truth, it might have been a hallucination or something. So Garrow had given the lawyers very detailed information about the location of the bodies. So the two lawyers decided that the only really good way to confirm what their client had told them would be to put on their hiking boots and go out and look for the remains of these two girls. But the other thing that really impelled them to undertake this disagreeable task is that Susan Petz had been missing for almost 3 weeks. And there was a possibility that she might still be alive. And the police investigator was really hysterical about that possibility. And the lawyers were very worried about it, too. Because if she was still alive, they wanted to find her in time for her to be rescued.
One of the ethical issues here is we have a 16-year-old girl who's been killed. She's down a mine shaft. She has parents who want to know. They don't want to know the worst, but they do want to know what's happened to her. And you have these people representing the man who killed her. What are the ethical choices available to them?
In the U.S. nowadays, the rules have changed a little bit. The rule now says if you know that your client is going to commit a crime that would cause severe injury or death to another person, you're allowed to reveal the information. But even now in the U.S., the rule as to a crime that was committed in the past is you're representing somebody on this charge. It's your job to protect those confidences. So they didn't really have any choice except to keep the information to themselves.
Did they, in fact, have contact with the families of the murdered girls?
Yes. First of all, one of the girls was named Alicia Houck. She was a high school student in Syracuse. And Frank Armani's daughter went to a parochial school in Syracuse with the Houck girls. And Alicia Houck's sister was in Frank's daughter's class. And Alicia Houck's dad was a custodian in the courthouse where Frank worked. And sometimes before calendar call, they had coffee together. So he actually knew this family. But after the Garrow case got started, Susan Petz, who had been an undergraduate at a college in Boston, her father came from Chicago to Syracuse to visit Armani, came to his office, and pretty much broke down in Frank's office and begged Frank to tell him if he knew where his daughter was.
And we should say that they didn't just know where the daughter was, that they took photos, and in one case, Frank Belgi moved one of the girls' heads back into position above her neck. So they know quite a lot that they're not telling, don't they?
They do. And Frank said that that visit from Susan Petz's father was just anguishing, that he wanted so badly to relieve the suffering of this man. But he really felt that when he had been sworn in as a lawyer in New York State, that he had made a solemn oath to keep his client's confidences, and that it would have been a betrayal of that oath to share this information. He told me that his mother was really angry at him because he wouldn't tell the parents. She found out later, of course. And he said, "Ma, a lawyer is like a priest." And his mother, who's, of course, Catholic, Italian Catholic, said, "But Frank, you're not a priest." And part of what one wants is for lawyers to actually shoulder that ordinary morality and struggle with it.
So do we have here a conflict between a personal morality, obviously you want to tell the parents, and professional ethics?
Yes, and that's really what the kind of famous issue in this case is about, is whether a lawyer, because of his special role, should be subject to a kind of different moral code than a regular human being. Because any normal person with knowledge of the location of a dead teenage girl, the first impulse, the first duty would be to tell the parents and the police and everybody else who wanted to know.
You're listening to The Philosopher's Zone on ABC Radio National with me, Alan Saunders. And apologies for my voice in this interview, which is just a little bit croaky. This week, we're talking about an infamous American court case that exposed the conflict between the ethical responsibility of lawyers and their personal morality. Here's Bill Houck, the father of murdered teenager Alicia Houck.
I was invited to his office. And when I got there, his girl said he wasn't in. And I called several different times for an appointment, and I was refused.
I don't think I would have been able to stand the pressure of that meeting. I just couldn't trust myself to meet him face to face.
The lawyer, Frank Armani. So does the case illustrate that client protection by definition involves lawyers having to be, or having to be prepared to be, dishonest or at least evasive about what they know? In other words, is the lawyer's position by definition an ethically problematic one? Law professor Lisa Lerman.
It does. And, you know, I think that especially if a lawyer is representing an indigent criminal defendant, that the justification for the lawyer to protect these type of confidences in a kind of absolute sense is more justifiable than if, for example, a lawyer is representing a large corporation that's charged with some kind of, you know, institutional white-collar financial crime. I just don't think the justification is the same. My sister does appellate criminal defense work in Alaska, and the way she puts it is when you're representing poor criminal defendants, all the resources are on the other side. That the prosecutor and the police, they have investigators, they have experts, they have all kinds of resources at their disposal. And the amount of resources that we allocate to defense representation is minuscule. And in light of that, it's like the lawyer is the only one on the side of the defendant. And the defendant, even if he's a sociopath, even if he's a disgusting person who drinks animal blood, he's still a human being. They wanted to use the information, though, to try to negotiate a deal with the prosecutor. Garrow could have been subject to the death penalty, or at least to life in prison. And they felt that he was mentally ill and that really a better solution would be for him to be found not guilty by reason of insanity and sent to a mental institution. So they, in going to find the remains of these two girls, were hoping to trade this information about two unsolved murders in exchange for a promise of not guilty by reason of insanity in the Domblewski case.
The way you put it makes it sound seriously unpleasant, because we're talking about two teenage girls who have been killed and you use the word trade. Is there something unethical in this? I mean, we can argue about whether there's something unethical in the whole process of plea bargaining, but is there anything unethical in this particular case?
Certainly questions have been raised about it, but I don't think so. In fact, at least in the States, probably over 95% of all criminal charges are resolved by plea bargaining, just as civil cases are almost all resolved through a negotiated settlement. And it's not like a corrupt, behind closed doors, unlawful deal making. The lawyers actually have information that will help the prosecutors to resolve other cases, and they're willing to give it up with their client's consent in exchange for a promise that Garrow would go to a mental hospital rather than to prison. And Garrow was actually terrified. He said to the lawyers, "Do you know what happens to child molesters in prison?" You know, he knew that he would be raped and or murdered by the other prisoners.
Frank Armani later decided he could breach the confidentiality of a client in certain circumstances. In this case, when he perceived his family to be under threat. Doesn't this undo his whole argument about the absolute importance of lawyer-client confidentiality?
I think it actually, it's one of the most surprising parts of the case, and it's one that most people don't know, but I think it vividly illustrates how much these decisions are a matter of judgment, and that the rules are not to be just obeyed absolutely, but that the lawyer has to think it through. What happened is that Garrow was sent to prison, and he actually pretended that he was paralyzed and was stuck in a wheelchair. So although he was in a maximum security prison, they didn't watch him all that carefully. And eventually, he scaled a wall and escaped from prison. And when they searched his prison cell, they found a hit list in his cell that included the names of both of his lawyers. And before that time, one time during the Domblewski trial, Armani's daughter, Dorina, had come into the courtroom, and Garrow had, who had never met her, turned to her and said, "Nice to see you again, Dorina." And that led Frank to believe that his client had actually been stalking his daughter. So at the point at which Garrow escaped from prison, Frank decided, and when he learned that he was on a hit list that had been made by his client, he decided that enough was enough, and he told the police what he knew about where Garrow might be hiding. And then the police went to search that location, found Garrow, and in the course of apprehending him, killed him. And I asked Frank, how did it feel to have revealed a confidence in a way that resulted in the death of his client? And he said, "I'm not a hero. My feet are of clay. I was relieved."
How did you feel about that as an answer? "I'm not a hero. My feet are of clay." It sounds a bit of a confession of weakness on his part. Or did you accept it as that? Or did you think, well, what would anybody else have done in those circumstances?
My reaction was to say, "No, Frank, that's not right. You are a hero." Because he did the right thing twice. And he did the right thing by being a lawyer up to a point that pushed him almost past what he could tolerate. And then by reverting back to his morality as a human being and doing what was absolutely compelled for his own personal safety. You know, I really think that if earlier in the case, if they had decided to cooperate with the police and reveal the information about the location of the remains of the girls, probably no one would have faulted them because it was such an extreme case. But I also think that at the point at which they were doing that, when they were about to go to trial on a murder case, that the better thing to do was to keep their mouths shut. And they revealed the information just as soon as they could do it without severely impacting their client. And I think it's easy to justify.
Lisa Lerman, Professor of Law at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. We've been talking about the trial of Robert Garrow, who murdered a number of teenagers in upstate New York in 1973. And thanks to PBS, the American Public Broadcaster, for use of the interviews with Frank Armani and others involved in the case. I'm Alan Saunders, the program's producer is Kyla Slavin, and the sound engineer on The Philosopher's Zone is Charlie McCune. Thanks for tuning in today. To take us out, Paul Simon, with a tune of his that went to number one on the American charts in the year we've been talking about, 1973.
When I was a little boy,
when I was just a boy,
the devil called my name.
When I was just a boy,
say now, who do you think you're fooling?
When I was just a boy,
I'm a consecrated boy.
When I was just a boy,
singer in Sunday choir. Oh, my mama loves me, she loves me.
Been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.